This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Afghanistan in the 1980s between the Afghan fighters known as the Mujahideen and the invading Soviet army transformed the world. The Afghan victory contributed to the fall of communism. The Afghans won with arms and training covertly funded by the CIA. Our arming of their jihad has had many unintended consequences. My guest, George Kreil, has written a new book about this story, which he describes as the biggest and most successful CIA covert campaign in history. Kreil is a longtime producer at 60 Minutes, who now works on 60 Minutes, too. His new book is called Charlie Wilson's War, named after the former Democratic Texas congressman who, along with CIA operative Gust Avracados, were the main figures behind the covert operation. Charlie Wilson was an unlikely figure to back a so-called holy war. Kreil says Wilson's reputation in Congress was as a seemingly corrupt, alcoholic, scandal-prone womanizer. We'll meet Wilson a little later. I asked George Kreil how Charlie Wilson was introduced to the Afghan cause.
Through a most unlikely figure, a Houston socialite who was part of the oil-rich world of Texas in the 70s, and an arch conservative who most reporters at the time who wrote about her described her as a kind of mix between Scarlett O'Hara, Dolly Parton, and I'd like to throw in Arianna Huffington. In any case, she was totally the kind of person that could only be created in Texas. And she was General Zia-ul Haq, the dictator of Pakistan's honorary consul and his principal advisor on America, if you can believe it. And she was also a great, passionate, conspiratorial anti-communist. And for some odd reason, she came upon her once the Russians invaded Afghanistan, that if she could just put Zia-ul Haq, this magnificent Muslim dictator, and the Mujahideen of Afghanistan, who were heroically fighting the Russians without any weapons, if she could put them together with this congressman she had met, who had supported the independent oil interests so effectively, that she could change the world. That they would combine and they would go deliver a lethal blow to the Soviet Empire, and that's curiously just what happened.
Now, Congressman Charlie Wilson managed to get a lot of money from the CIA for arming the Mujahideen. How did he, as a congressman, manage to make that connection with the CIA?
With great difficulty. The CIA, at all costs, wanted to avoid having anything to do with him. They felt that he was a cocaine-sniffing, scandal-prone, skirt-chasing danger, you know, probably the most notorious, wildest man of Congress at the time. And their reaction when he came into their lives offering to increase their budget to fight a secret war in Afghanistan was to look with absolute horror at such an offer. They felt, with friends like that, we need no enemies. And what ensued was a knockdown, drag-out fight. But it was only possible because of the curiosities of Congress and his position on the Appropriations Committee.
How important was he on the Appropriations Committee, and how did that help him?
Well, if you think of our country is so huge, and the number of things that Congress has to deal with are just so vast that it all gets broken down into areas of responsibility. And if you're, when it came to the CIA, if you were not on one of several committees, you really couldn't even talk to them. And no congressman, no member of Congress had ever been able to insinuate himself inside an actual covert operation. That was a line that had been drawn and maintained very effectively ever since the beginning of the Cold War and the beginning of the CIA. But what you have is, with the Appropriations Committee, where the money is actually spent, when you drop it down to the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, you will have 11 people in the House responsible ultimately for deciding how much money the Pentagon gets, the NSA, the CIA, all the intelligence agencies. And Charlie Wilson was one of those 11. And it was just like you always heard, with pork barrel. in that you could see that one of the powerful members on that subcommittee would suddenly have defense contracts in his district, and he'd have bases and things like that. Charlie Wilson was one of the people that was a brilliant backroom politician, and he just always voted for everybody's programs and never asked for anything in return until the Afghan War. I'm sorry, that's not really true. He never asked for anything in return except for Israel. He was a pioneering non-Jewish champion of Israel on the Appropriations Committee. But after Israel, it was the only thing he really called for and asked for was his colleagues' support in escalating the secret war in Afghanistan over the objection of the CIA.
No, he finally had an ally in the CIA. Who was the ally?
A most unexpected character named Gus Avracados. By the time that Wilson met him, he was both had a very distinguished history at the CIA as a kind of, I call him the blue-collar James Bond, but also a person who had alienated most everybody. And he was very, very distressed with what he thought bureaucratic cowardice that had come over the CIA and the domination of the agency by lawyers. And what happened in this case is that Avracados, who had been making his way in a very dramatic and bizarre fashion to a position in the Afghan task force, had encountered Wilson's attempt to force the CIA into a larger war. And without telling any of his superiors, he took off in a car, went down to Congress, and entered Wilson's office completely unauthorized and confronted him with the challenge that if you think you want to fight the Russians and kill the Russians more than me, you're crazy. And he did it in such a way that it made Charlie feel that maybe he might physically attack him. He's a really tough customer. And from that moment on, the two of them began to engage in a partnership and what amounts to down and dirty plotting to figure out how, with Avracados' information of how things happen in the CIA and what Wilson should say using his power on the Appropriations Committee, how they could put the CIA into a box where it had no choice but to accept stunning amounts of money that they didn't want to spend.
How did they do that? What was their approach?
The moment Avracados walked into the Rayburn House office building, closed the door, and began to talk to Wilson, everything changed. And it changed because what he did is that he told Wilson exactly what to say to Bill Casey, who was then the CIA director. And he did it in the following way. He said, as soon as I leave, you call the director and say that you just got $50 million more that you can give to the CIA, and you want to know if they can use it. And by the way, I just had run into Gus Avracados, and I told him about this and asked him to look into it. At that point, Casey had no real choice but to call Avracados and ask if he could use the money, because he needed to know that Avracados had not told Wilson that he could. And what Wilson always had in the back of his ace and hidden away that he could pull out is that Ronald Reagan's rhetoric was so powerful and his popularity so great that he would simply say, if you do not support the Afghans with everything they need and with the money I'm offering you, I'll go to the president who is calling for this support and complain. And he meant it. He meant that he would probably destroy the CIA bureaucrats. And nobody in a high position in the CIA had ever engaged a congressman willing to out them, essentially.
Was the CIA very interested in supporting the Afghans? I mean, you talk in your book about how this was one war in which the real enemy, the way they saw it, the real enemy, the Soviets, could actually be directly engaged. It wasn't a war with Soviet proxies. It was a war with the Soviets themselves. Was that very appealing to the CIA?
Yes and no, but mainly no, in that they didn't want to do it in the way that Wilson and Avracados ultimately forced them to do it.
Too risky?
Yeah, much too risky. I mean, what had happened by that year, or by that time in the early 1980s, the CIA had more or less established a pattern of conduct where they were engaged in endless war. It was almost as if it was viewed as permanent campaigns on the fringes to contain the Soviets. And the one thing they didn't want to do is to take on any kind of provocative campaigns that could escalate into some unforeseen drama. And in the case of Afghanistan and Pakistan, they had no choice but to use General Zia, the military dictator of Pakistan, President Zia, and Pakistan as the base of operations. And it was provocative because the United States, for the very first time, was supporting anti-communist guerrillas who were moving to kill Soviet soldiers. And that had never happened in the Cold War. It was the very first time that the United States actually set out to kill our enemy, to mount operations designed to kill Russians.
So the CIA didn't want the Soviets to know that it was that Americans were arming the Afghans to the extent that we were.
There was a kind of a sense that we could get away with a lot if the United States was just sensible, and that if it did a calibrated escalation, in which the idea would be to win fantastic propaganda victories, which we were doing, to inflict a certain amount of pain, which we were doing through blowing things up and killing a certain number of Russians. But what changed the dynamic here completely is that Wilson, in conjunction with Gustav Rakatos, transformed the whole idea. They suddenly decided to hijack a covert policy and to take the United States for the very first time in the Cold War into a all-out, winner-take-all confrontation, to turn the tables on the Russians and give them in Afghanistan their own Vietnam. It was sort of payback time in their minds. And it was something that the CIA at all costs wanted to avoid doing. And it was a knockdown, drag-out fight that stretched over a couple of years and then ultimately resulted in a total victory for Charlie Wilson. Terry, can I give you a context here?
Sure.
You know, if you think back to that time when this story begins, right after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, Christmas of 1979, just about a month later, the Afghans are a lost cause. The whole world has come to recognize, with 100,000 Russian troops in Afghanistan, with the invincible Red Army occupying the country, that the story is over. And the terrible scenes that were broadcast around the world of the Afghans began to flee their country and the beginnings of what came to be called a genocidal war were very evident, and there was nothing really that they could do to change the picture. They just had World War I rifles and hunting rifles and this ferocious fighting spirit and conviction. But at that moment, they had nothing really that could help them other than, as in a fairy tale, they needed a heroic figure to emerge out of somewhere and magically come to their rescue. And there was such a person, curiously. But at that moment, he was stepping into a hot tub in Las Vegas at Caesar's Palace in the Fantasy Suite with two naked women with cocaine in their purses. And it is so odd to think that this is the man, Charlie Wilson, Congressman Charlie Wilson, who will get himself out of the hot tub and pull himself together in about a year and a half after this, discover the Afghans, discover this cause, and for a period of about 5 years, he will emerge as the centerpiece in the biggest and meanest and most successful CIA campaign in history, and will be responsible for giving or making possible a total victory for the for militant Islam in the greatest jihad of modern history.
Do you think that the fundamentalist Muslims who Charlie Wilson helped arm had a sense of who he was as a man, and you know, his kind of sexual appetites, his whole world, which was all about, which had so much to do with pleasure seeking?
There was a line that has always haunted me, that's helped me to follow this story, because the characters are so wonderfully bizarre and fascinating. And it goes like this, that Allah writes straight with crooked lines. And it's the only way to make sense out of any of this, because how could Charlie Wilson, with personal belly dancers and beauty queens and hot tubs and naked women, somehow become the sponsor and patron of the greatest jihad with these fundamentalist Muslims who he loved and who loved him, other than through mystical forces that you can't really explain?
Did he bring his friends, the former beauty queens and the belly dancer, with him to Afghanistan?
Always. First time he went to out to Afghanistan, he was charmed by the Mujahideen. He was moved by them. But he was something of a hedonist, I guess you'd have to say, at that point. He was caught up in what he calls the longest midlife crisis in history. And he decided that once he found out there was no alcohol, no women, that he was never going to the Islamic world again without a good Christian girl by his side. And the people he brought were just unbelievable. They were almost invariably, they were former beauty queens, small-town girls with big, wondrous eyes that were being given a queen-for-a-day experience that they, to this day, look back on as being the high point of their lives. And even a belly dancer from Dallas, Texas.
Well, let's get back to the covert arming of the Mujahideen. What arrangement was Charlie Wilson, with the CIA, able to arrange to covertly get high-tech weapons to the Afghan Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets in the 1980s?
You know, you'd think that the CIA could take care of all of its own arms purchases easily. But in the Cold War, they had a hard and fast rule that they would not ever introduce weapons into a secret war that could be traced back to the United States. And so they had to go through an elaborate process in the black markets to get Soviet weapons that could be claimed to be captured on the battlefield. And the big problem that existed at that point was these flying gunships, which the Hind helicopter, which no matter how many times the Mujahideen, the Afghans, would shoot at that helicopter, the bullets would just bounce off of its armor, and they would sit up there and just mow down people by the thousands. And it was a terrible problem, and Wilson became completely preoccupied by it, and to a certain extent, the CIA people did too. But they didn't know what to do, and they didn't really know where to go. It just so happened, though, and how you could explain this, I don't know. It just so happened that Charlie's best friend and drinking buddy at that point was the minister, the wildly powerful Minister of Defense of Egypt, Mohammed Abu Ghazala, who had told Charlie, come to Egypt and I will open my storehouse of weapons and you can buy whatever you want. And Egypt had once been a client state of Russia, so they had all these weapons. And so the CIA, so Wilson, in his very first trip after getting his foot in the door with the CIA, led this delegation headed by Gustav Rakatos to Egypt, where the doors to the arsenals were opened because of his great friend Mohammed.
So the United States used Soviet missiles that the Soviets sold to Egypt that the U.S. bought from Egypt to covertly arm the Afghans against the Soviets.
That was one of many, many channels. But at that time, once the war started to escalate and they needed, you know, we're talking numbers that are hard to conceive, maybe as many as a 500,000 Afghans, fundamentalist Islamic warriors who were carrying CIA-issued weapons. And once Charlie Wilson's war began with his funding levels and Avrocados's secret partnership. They started to introduce very sophisticated weapons and mixes of weapons, and this called for getting governments to provide that, that had Soviet manufactured weapons, the Chinese, the Egyptians. And in this case, there's a fantastic story connected to each one of these channels that were opened up.
Once the CIA funding of the covert operations in Afghanistan increased, where did Pakistan fit in?
From the beginning, there was no war. There was no Afghan war. There was no Afghan resistance, were it not for Pakistan. And even today, when you hear about the great hunt for bin Laden, there is an area called a tribal zone between Afghanistan and that stretches into Pakistan, but for a certain number of miles, tribal law prevails, not Pakistan law, and it really is an extension of Afghanistan. And so you have the same tribal mix, and the war was always based really in Pakistan and in this tribal zone, where the same primarily Pashtun warriors, the famous Afghans who defeated the English and the Russians, were based. But Pakistan was everything, because its president, Zia-ul Haq, was a dictator, and so he was able to dictate that there would be a base of operations for the Afghans. But he put down a pretty hard set of conditions to the CIA in the United States, which is that his intelligence service, the ISI, would be responsible for distributing the weapons and running the Afghans with limited supervision from the CIA.
There are other things you say he wanted from the United States. For example, he expected the United States to turn its head regarding Pakistan's nuclear weapons program.
Well, he certainly did. And at the heart of everything, curiously, with Zia was not so much his dealings with the U.S. government, but the set of relationships he had with this woman who got Charlie Wilson into the war, Joanne Herring, the unusual Texas character who was the honorary consul to Pakistan, and Charlie Wilson, because Zia came to rely on Wilson's word that if Charlie said that he could count on military assistance of a certain amount, that then he would go ahead and allow escalations of the war. And every time there were huge battles over whether Pakistan was working on the bomb, on what everybody called the Islamic bomb, there would be knockdown, drag-out fights in which Wilson would always organize the resistance and keep the money flowing. And it did keep flowing, and it was a condition of Zia's. And it kept flowing until the Russians left, whereupon we immediately discovered that they were working on the bomb, and with great apparent or ostensible shock, imposed sanctions and cut off military assistance.
Were there any concerns in Congress or in the CIA or in the Reagan administration that the United States was going to be arming Islamic fundamentalists with high-tech weapons, training these warriors how to use the weapons, while knowing that a lot of the Islamic fundamentalists hated the United States? They didn't just hate the Soviets.
There was certainly a good deal of concern inside the CIA in the early years when Charlie Wilson was trying to force them to escalate this war. And one of their perfectly understandable concerns was that, you know, what happens afterward? What are the unintended consequences? Is it a good idea to get, is to make this a huge war? Would it provoke a Pakistani or an attack by the Red Army, the Russians, on Pakistan? What consequences could that have? What are we going to do with all of these Muslim fundamentalists? What kind of weapons, what kind of training is appropriate to give to them? And all of those questions were very real and part of the initial battle that the CIA waged to try to prevent this massive escalation. But the truth is, once they got into it, once they lost the battle with Charlie Wilson and the secret partner, Gustav Rakatos, helping him from within the CIA, once they lost it and the money started to flow in and the war started to escalate and the tide started to turn, the CIA became absolutely giddy and thrilled at this battle, because it was the first time that they were actually setting out to kill the enemy, to engage him in a winner-take-all battle. And no one thought that this was possible to win, but they increasingly came to think it would be. And then it happened. And for the longest time, this was viewed as the great triumph of the CIA in the last campaign of the Cold War.
How long do you think it took for the CIA to start thinking about the blowback, about the bad unintended consequences of arming the Mujahideen?
I think we have a problem in our country, period, when it comes to the aftermath of campaigns like this. You're starting to see it in Afghanistan today. Hopefully we don't find it in Iraq. But, I think that the simple answer is that they really worried about it but didn't think too much about it for a long time, because so many incredible things were happening. Almost immediately after the Russians withdrew, after this thing that President Zia of Afghanistan called the miracle of the century, when the Red Army turned tail and walked out with their own Vietnam haunting them, everything started to tumble. You know, it wasn't very long before the wall came down, and it wasn't long before the Velvet Revolution and the fall of communism. Too many things were happening that were too exciting for anyone to worry about what was happening inside Afghanistan. And because it was a secret campaign, and because people didn't really understand that it had been a huge victory, there was no sense of accountability to the Afghans, or a sense that we had to worry about whether we had a responsibility to stay in there and try to help rebuild the country. So it was the blowback concerns, the whole sense of the unintended consequences, probably didn't really set in until the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993.
George Crile, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
George Crile is the author of the new book, Charlie Wilson's War, The Extraordinary Story of the Largest Covert Operation in History. Crile is also a producer at 60 Minutes, too.